Hi, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of Whiskey in the Writings, coming to you pre-January 2025 when we actually launch Whiskey in the Writings. This is a Christmas edition for us, and I'm here sporting my Christmas sweater. Go Eagles. We're crushing it right now in 2024 of December, but we are getting close to Christmas, and I thought it'd be fun to do a Christmas episode of Whiskey and the Writings with you. And so today we got a lot to talk about. Grab your drink, have a sip, let's dive in. All right, folks, I got with me here my 1910 Pendleton Rye. This is a 12 year that I'm gonna pour over my Christmas cup here with a little bit of ice to cut it. This 12 year is a little bit sharp, and it's got a bite to it, so we're going to cut a little bit with ice. And I'm so glad that you are with us. Today we're going to have a Christmas edition of Whiskey in the Writings, and we're going to be talking about the story of Jesus. And we're going to be looking at the two stories of Jesus that we have here in the Gospels. And so if you don't know, there are four biographies of Jesus, these stories that we get about the life of Jesus told through the lens of four specific authors that we have, at least in our Bibles. And those are Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But did you know that only two of those biographies even mention the birth of Jesus, right? Which is super interesting to think about in our Western culture. The birth of Jesus is such a big holiday. We do so much. Even at our house, we have the tree, we have the lights, we get the presents, and we read the story, and we do big services at church, and it's a big deal in Western culture. And yet only two of the Gospels even mention the birth of of Jesus. And what's even more interesting than that is that as you go through the narrative of the New Testament, it's as if the birth of Jesus isn't that important, which might sound crazy to say, but Paul like barely mentions it, if at all. Like Peter doesn't mention it. Like these writings that we have, James doesn't mention it. And they talk more about the resurrection of Jesus than they do the birth of Jesus. It's like the birth of Jesus is a side story to the main arc and the main narrative of what the purpose of Jesus's coming is all about. In the New Testament, the emphasis is about resurrection, what Jesus does through his death, his burial, and his resurrection. His birth is barely mentioned. It gets very little airtime in your New Testaments, and yet we make such a big deal of it. So let's look at, here at Whiskey in the Writings, why do the two biographies spend time talking about the birth of Jesus? And that's what we're going to look at today. Why do these two authors, we're looking at Matthew and we're looking at Luke, and we're going to draw out some observations of why do they even bring this up? If Mark doesn't even mention it, and John talks a little bit about John the Baptist, but basically doesn't mention it, Paul basically doesn't mention it very much. None of the other authors really talk about it. In fact, in the first century, leading into like after the apostolic fathers passed away, it's still really not even that mentioned in early Christian writings. And so let's look at why these authors included these stories of Jesus's birth. Why did they do that? That's what we're going to be looking at today. And we're going to be starting by looking at the themes that go behind these Gospels that influence why they include stories and don't include stories. If you don't know, these biographies don't read like a modern biography. Take, for example, if you were to buy off the bookshelf a biography on Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Edison, you're going to get these kind of chronological retellings of their lives. Most of the time, it starts with like their birth and what happened at their birth, and then it will talk about their early childhood, and then it'll talk about like their early careers and what they did as they entered into the workforce, and then what happened and to them as adults, and what influenced those things, and who they married and the kids they had, and then their later life, and you get the idea. That's how a modern biography reads. But all historians look at the biographies of Jesus, not like a biography that we would read in a modern sense. They call them ancient biographies. More particularly, ancient Greco-Roman biographies. And so when you look at the writings of the Gospels, they resemble more these Greco-Roman biographies of the same era that they were writing. And so they like any of us, right? If you write a biography today, you're going to write like we write biographies because that's the age that we live in. And so it makes perfect sense that these Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, these biographers are writing just like they would have with their contemporaries because that's how what they knew and that's how they wrote. And when you look at contemporary biographies of this first century era, maybe a little bit before, maybe a little bit after, what you see are very similar writing styles. You maybe get a little bit of the early childhood, but the point of a Greco-Roman biography isn't to tell you all the details of their lives. It's to focus on the details that highlight the reason why they are who they are. So if you were to read a biography on, like, let's say, Julius Caesar by like an ancient biographer, like maybe Tacitus, a historian like Tacitus, you might read something that tells you a little bit about his childhood, but only if it serves the purpose to highlight who they are as a king in the world. And so you're going to focus more on the big feats and deeds that they do. And so there's not a lot on their early development unless it highlights why they're there. It serves a greater purpose. And so this is exactly what you see in the Gospels. For a gospel like Mark, he doesn't talk about the childhood of Jesus because he's not interested in making that point. He doesn't see how those details help his story in retelling why Jesus is there. John, the same reason. He doesn't go into those details because he has a different point that he's trying to make. However, Matthew and Luke do utilize the birth narratives of Jesus, and they tell them from different perspectives. And so if you were to read side by side Matthew and Luke, you're going to get these birth narratives that are very, very different. They're going to highlight different aspects of the birth of Jesus that serve a main point that they're trying to make. And this is very important. The gospel writers aren't being secretive. They're not trying to pull the curtain over your eyes. They know exactly what they're doing. And when we respect the purpose and intention of their writing, it becomes more clear why they tell the stories that they tell. I'm getting fired up here, so I need a drink. So, what we're going to do here is we're going to look at three examples in Matthew, and then we're going to look at three examples in Luke that help us understand the birth story from their perspectives. And then maybe we can understand a little bit about why those gospels were written the way that they were written. And so, I'm excited to get started. I love talking about this. One of the traditions that I have on Christmas mornings is reading these stories and really letting them sit in my heart, and in my mind, because as you're going to see here, these are meaningful stories that have been formed by these authors. These narratives have been crafted to communicate a certain truth about Jesus that's important for us to reflect on if we're going to try to make sense of who this Jesus is and how we ought to follow him. Whatever tradition you have, here's my encouragement, is that this Christmas season, is you wake up in the morning or you spend time with your family or wherever you're at, you take a moment, you pause, and you reflect on the coming of Jesus and the why of his coming, which is what Matthew and Luke are trying to emphasize with their narratives of the birth of Jesus. Now, we could spend time talking about different myths of the Christmas season. There's probably a lot out there already talking about these things. So we're not going to talk about all these things. I really just want to focus on maybe not just, you know, is Christmas, you know, December 25th when Jesus was literally born? The answer to that is no. You know, how many wise men were at the birth of Jesus? The answer is zero. Like, we could spend some time like deep diving some of those thoughts and ideas. That's not this post. I really want to look at why the authors actually tell us these stories to begin with, and what then can we learn from them. And so we're going to dive right in. I've got some notes up here for me to reference. We're going to look at three areas in Matthew, and then we're going to look at three areas in Luke. And so let's set the stage for Matthew. Matthew's gospel is special. It's the first gospel that we get in our English New Testaments. It's not commonly thought of as the first gospel that was written. Mark is traditionally that. And all scholarship kind of have a general agreement that Luke and Matthew copied portions of Mark and then added some of their own narrative within it. And you're going to get some of that in Matthew. Like, for instance, Matthew's gospel in chapter 1 starts with this massive genealogy. And you got to ask yourself, why does it start with the genealogy? Well, it's on the surface, it's trying to lead you to a point to see Jesus connected to the Davidic lineage of a kingship, a leader, someone who is called to lead the people of Israel, to take over this role of king in leading Israel into a place of prominence once again within their world. And so let's set the stage culturally here. So at the time of Jesus, it's the first century. If we're looking at the region of Israel or Canaan or this region on the map, it is occupied by the Roman Empire. Okay, so this is a Greco-Roman society. So after the Persians had conquered the land, then the Greeks came in under Alexander, and they Hellenized the region, which made it predominantly Greek. And so the common language at this time that everyone learned growing up and most likely spoke was Koine Greek, common Greek. And so that's where you get the Greco. But then the Greeks were conquered by the Romans. And the Romans came in and they were the superpower of the day. And they merged these cultures, this Roman culture plus this Greek culture. And this is where we get the term Greco-Roman. And because it's this blended hybrid of this culture. Well, they were the big rulers of this region. And so if you were an Israelite, a Jewish person living in Jerusalem or a nearby region like Galilee, you were under occupation of a foreign invader, a foreign ruler, the Romans. And you were trying to understand and wrestling with the tension of this is our home, and yet we are in oversight and bondage to a foreign invader. And the tension that you might have had within yourself is, how do we be free people, free to live in our land as we see fit without the oversight of an invading army and culture? And so they were wrestling with these ideas and concepts, and they were hopeful that God would step in and bring a deliverer that would free them from the bondage of that oppression, of that slavery. And the word here, slavery, is very specific, and it's very intentional for Mark's gospel. So when you put yourself in the frame of mind of a ancient first century Judean Jew who is living, trying to make a living for themselves, and yet they are in bondage and slavery. They're paying taxes to Caesar. The Roman authorities are overseeing their land. They don't have freedom. They feel like slaves. And the question you might ask yourself, if you were that person, is God going to deliver us? Will God free us from this bondage? Matthew enters into that narrative, writing his biography, organizing the story of Jesus intentionally to answer that question with an emphatic yes. Yes, he will, and yes, he has. Let's take a look. If you have your Bibles, let's go ahead and open up to Matthew. This is the first gospel in your New Testament, the first writing in your New Testament. And chapter one is that genealogy. It's trying to set the stage of this lineage connection to this birth narrative, to a greater narrative that's being sown about a king and a deliverer that's supposed to be the one to bring them into their own land and their own sovereignty. And so there are three things that we're going to do here. And I'm going to set the stage with this. What most scholars say about Matthew is that he is trying to map Jesus' story onto the story of Moses and the Exodus. And there's lots of connection points that can be made here that maybe I ought to make another post in the future about this. But for now, just ride with me on this thought, okay? Matthew is trying to get its audience, his audience, the readers, the hearers of this story, to see the story of Jesus mapping onto the greater narrative of Moses and the Exodus. How do we see this in the birth story? Well, there are three things that I want to point out in regards to this connection. And before I jump in, let's get a little refill here. I hope you're staying with me. I hope you're doing all right. We're going to get through this here. Okay, so the first thing that we can point out that has the similarities is how Matthew talks about a king who seeks to kill children. Well, what do I mean by that? If you're familiar with the story of the Exodus and Moses, you have Pharaoh. And when Pharaoh sees that the nation of Israel has grown too big, and he's afraid that maybe they might revolt and take over, what is the response of Pharaoh? Well, in the Exodus story, if you've seen the movie, Moses has all the firstborn kids killed, right? Famous story, tragic story. If you're familiar with the Exodus story, which they would have been, those echoes would have been everywhere. And so what happens is that when Herod in the Matthew story, the king at the time, learns that the wise men had tricked him and he becomes afraid that there's a new king coming, what does he do? He has the kids killed. Let's take a look. In Matthew chapter 2, the Magi come to visit, and there is a prophecy that is spoken in Matthew chapter 2, verse 6, and it goes like this. And I'm reading out of the NET version of the Bible. There's a link to that version if you wanted to buy it on Amazon. It says this in Matthew chapter 2, verse 6. And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are in no way least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people of Israel. So here is the prophecy. So the prophecy is that there is coming a ruler, someone who's going to lead Israel. Well, if there's a new ruler coming into town, who does that threaten? The current ruler, right? The current ruler is threatened by this. And so what is the response at this point? So it says this, that we've got Herod privately summoned the wise men to determine from them where the star had appeared. So he's bringing the wise men together. And after he'd been tricked by the wise men in verse 16. So the wise men, mislead Herod so that Herod doesn't buy into what they're there for. Herod finds out about this. And in verse 16, it says this: when Herod saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, he became enraged. He sent men to kill all the children in Bethlehem and throughout the surrounding region from the age of 2 and under, according to the time they had learned from the wise men. So what do we see here? We see a parallel. Just like the king who was threatened by Israel kill all the children, this king in this story does the very same thing. It's like he's another Pharaoh. And so we see this mapping on to this story. And so the readers of this are going, wait a minute, that sounds familiar. That sounds familiar. The other thing that takes place, do you remember the part in the Moses story where he sees an Egyptian being beaten by the Israelite beaten by the Egyptian guard, and he steps in and he kills the Egyptian guard. And then he flees for his life. He goes to Midian, the desert. He leaves so he can get away to escape the punishment of what's going to happen to him if he stayed because he killed. And so he kills this Egyptian and he flees to the desert. And that's where he stays for 40 years. Well, in the same way, what happens to Jesus when the threat of his life comes into play, when the angel shows up to Joseph and tells Joseph, hey, get up and take off to Egypt. Leave, get out of this place. And so they leave, but that leave is for a temporary time. That leave was eventually to come back. And so what you have here in verse 13, it says this in chapter 2, after they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, get up and take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to look for the child to kill him. And so you have this very similar story of this leaving of the place to simply return back for deliverance. And so both Moses and Jesus are associated with this leaving to a desert as a place of refuge, a time of protection, as it were, and both are going to return to fulfill their divine mission. And so again, you have this mapping on to the story. The third thing I'll draw out here is that there is a prophecy of a calling out of Egypt that takes place. And so Moses is called by God to go to Egypt, to call them out of Egypt, to bring deliverance from their slavery. And in Hosea chapter 1, there is a prophecy that's echoed in Matthew that's all about coming out of Egypt. And it's found here in, again, chapter 2, verse 15. It says this: he stayed there until Herod died. So he's in Egypt, Jesus and his parents. In this way, it was spoken by the Lord through the prophet was fulfilled. I called my son out of Egypt. That's from Hosea chapter 11, verse 1. So what Matthew's doing is Matthew's mapping on intentionally to Jesus this narrative of Moses, that he is one that frees them out of slavery. And so even as you continue on in Matthew's gospel, you get the baptism of Jesus where he's gone through water. Then you have the time in the desert where he is tempted, just like the Israelites were tempted in the desert. There are all of these connections that are even interwoven into the narrative of Matthew that maps him onto Moses. And so here's the question. Why does Matthew tell us the story of Jesus? And the answer to that question is that because the birth story of Jesus is much like the story of Moses. And what Moses, that story of Moses of bringing the Israelites out of slavery into their own existence, into their own being as a people under the direction and leadership of God, is the same thing that Jesus does as he comes into the world. He is the one that, if we trust and follow him, lead us out of slavery and into the leadership and direction and oversight of the one true God. The two are the same. So the question is, why does Moses tell us the birth story? Well, I believe it's this. I believe we have the birth story in Moses or in Matthew because he's trying to get us to see the connections of the birth story of Jesus to the story of Moses. He's setting us up. And if we understand that what Jesus comes to do is actually to bring us out of the slavery and bondage of an oppressed, brutal regime and empire and into new life and into a new existence, the story of Jesus becomes a beautiful message of hope, of this beautiful message of a future reality that is open to us here and now as we put our trust in Jesus. So when we read the story of Jesus's birth in Matthew's gospel, we need not focus on did this or that or in this way happen. The point of Matthew is that he's trying to get us to see how Jesus is the new Moses. And for an ancient Israelite, that would have been hopeful. And for us as people here in the 21st century, that is equally hopeful that just like Moses, Jesus offers us a way forward into freedom. And if we can see that in the message and the hope of Jesus, we can find new life and a life far more abundant than we can ever imagine or dream. Now, what about Luke, like Matthew, is trying to do something very specific with his gospel. Luke is doing something specific and yet different than Matthew's gospel. Luke has a different angle that he's trying to approach the narrative of the birth story of Jesus with. And if Matthew's all about Jesus being the new Moses, Luke is all about Jesus being the new king. It's as if Luke is trying to set the stage to tell us there's a new king in town. And his name is Jesus. And if you are someone who is living in, let's just say, in Rome, or let's say in Ephesus or Thessalonica, these cities that are Roman occupied, you have a king that you serve. Can you guess his name? It would be Caesar. And at the time of Jesus, it was Caesar Augustus. He was the king. He was God incarnate, ruling on behalf of the gods here on earth. And so there were cults to Caesar Augustus, worshiping him as a god. And this was a narrative that was played out in the Greco-Roman culture and world, to see the Caesar as a god. He was the one true almighty ruler of everything. And if you were a Roman citizen, you lived under that culture. So if Matthew's gospel is trying to help the Jews see, the Jewish people to see how Jesus is the new Moses, Luke's gospel is trying to help the Gentiles, the non-Jewish people, see how Jesus is actually the rightful heir king, right? He is the new king. And so what are three things in the birth story of Jesus, according to Luke, that we can see that help point us to Jesus being king? Well, let's start with this. There is an angelic announcement in Luke's story. And so in Luke chapter 2, verse 10, I'll go ahead and turn there now. In Luke chapter 2, verse 10, there is an angelic proclamation of Jesus' arrival, and it says this, "But the angel said to them," this is to the shepherds, "do not be afraid. Listen carefully, for I proclaim to you good news." This is the Evangelion. This is what we call the gospel, the good news that brings great joy to all the people. "Today, your Savior, your Deliverer, is born in the city of David. He is the Christ, he is Christ the Lord." This term, Christ, is a specific term that means anointed one. In Hebrew, it is Messiah, which denotes a kingship authority, a ruler, a ruling authority, that's a person who's anointed to be the ruling authority. This is that term, Christ. He is the Lord. And Lord, as you can imagine, in any type of scenario where you have like kingships, a Lord is someone who has oversight over you, that you are submitted to their governing and rule in your life. And so this proclamation is significant in Luke's narrative because of the announcements that were made about new rulers and kings in the Greco-Roman world. You see, the word Evangelion means gospel. We use the English translation to mean good news. And did you know that the gospel writers, when they use the word evangelion, they're being super intentional? They're actually taking a word that would have been known by the Greco-Roman populace to be used as a word to announce a king's announcement, an announcement by a king. And so in Luke chapter 2, when it says that I proclaim to you good news, Luke is intentionally weaving into the narrative a term that was only used by a empire, a Caesar, a king, to announce something. Evangelion was a word that was used all throughout the Roman Empire to announce something that the king was trying to say. That might be like the king has an evangelion. From here on out, there's a 10% decrease on taxes. Or you might get a declaration in your town of Galilee that might say, "Hey, we have a new evangelion. Caesar Augustus has been born to the world, the rightful king." Or you might get a evangelion that there is that Caesar has announced this important thing that they want you to know. This is how the term was used, and it is very intentional for Luke to use the same verbiage to announce the coming of Jesus. What Luke is doing is he's being so smart here. He's actually tapping into the context of this time to take a word that they were very familiar with, associated usually with the Caesars and the kings of that day, and tying it to the person of Jesus. This is brilliant, right? So what Luke's doing with the birth story of Jesus is going, "Hey guys, let me tell you, there's a new evangelion. Let me tell you who it is. It is this anointed one who is here to come and rule." And he shares this information with these shepherds. It's this beautiful story that Luke is weaving here. Another thing here is the comparison, like I said, to Caesar Augustus. In Luke chapter 2, verse 1, he says this, "Now in those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus to register all the empire, the taxes." And so this Caesar Augustus, did you know this? That Caesar was actually called the Son of God. This was a title for Caesar Augustus. And so when Luke ties this narrative of this birth story of a new Son of God, He is actually being very intentional to tie this and map this onto a new king. If Caesar Augustus is the son of God, Luke actually says, no, there's a new son of God in town, and his name is Jesus. And so we have these comparisons to this kingship that's happening here. And then you have this heavenly announcement of peace and glory. And this is number 3 in chapter 2, verse 14. Okay, so this is what the angels show up praising and announcing. They say this, glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace among people with whom he is pleased. Do you see this there? It says, peace among people. Now, if you were a Roman citizen living in the first century, there is only one empire that has brought peace. And that peace that they brought was called Praxa Romana, which is the peace of this empire that the Romans believed that through violence and through force, they would actually bring peace to the empire. And so they would go around, and there were many battles that the Roman Empire fought, but they believed that that was their divine place, their place on this earth to actually bring the peace to all the world. And this was their whole marching orders. And you would hear of this Praxa Romana peace that the Roman Empire brings. And yet, what Luke does so subversely is actually introduce Jesus as the one who brings peace. So no longer is Caesar Augustus the son of God. No longer is Caesar Augustus the one that brings the Evangelion, the good news, and no longer is Caesar Augustus the one who brings peace. Luke is being so subversive here to the culture by saying it's actually Jesus. Why does Luke tell us the birth narrative of Jesus? Well, he's trying to get its audience to see that this narrative of Jesus's birth is entwined into a belief system that they already have. And their belief system is that they are already under the rule and authority of a king. And what Luke will begin to do through the rest of his gospel is invite its listeners and hearers to not put their trust in the empire that they have seen, but put their trust in a new empire, a new kingdom of God, where God's rule and reign, where he will bring in the peace and this to the world. And this is a good news to the world, because he will bring peace, because he is the true and one and only Son of God. Y'all, this is dope, right? This is so great that we have this here. And so when we read Luke's gospel, our goal shouldn't be asking these questions like, well, did it literally happen? Did an angel literally come down and appear to them? And was there a star that moved in the sky? And then you have to wrestle with other questions like, well, do stars move, or do we move? And what does that look like? And how can we trace back astrologically these events to prove the Bible? And it becomes robotic and no longer alive and living. And if you place yourself back into the story that Luke is trying to tell you, there's something more beautiful and more amazing. And if you put yourself back into the story that Matthew's trying to tell you, it becomes alive and dynamic, because Matthew's saying the coming of Jesus brings you freedom from slavery, from the slavery of this world and the sin and the death, and will teach you how to become a better human if you follow the new Moses. And if you trust him, like Luke says, to be your king, he will lead you to a place of peace. And that, my friends, is great, great news. And I can't help but get fired up. And I'm sorry if I get too riled up here, but y'all, this is good news. And this is what makes the Bible so stinking rad, is that this is what it's about when you read it. And if you're not excited right now to read your Bible more, come on, y'all. Take another sip, maybe. Here's the thing, guys. This Christmas season, the focus isn't whether he was in a manger or like his like somber coming into the world, and it's like this little baby in a manger, and all I can think of is Talladega Nights, and it's like, you know, baby Jesus, you know, I love baby Jesus. And for me, I get fired up when I read these stories, because there's something happening in the world when Jesus comes into the picture. And these two gospel writers are tapping into that narrative, you know, that they're trying to get these readers, the people that would have read this for the first time, to see a picture of Jesus that is far more dynamic and beautiful and amazing than you had ever imagined or dreamed, y'all. Jesus is the new Moses who rescues you from the slavery in the pits of this world and brings you into a new life. And Jesus, according to Luke, is the king that actually brings you peace if you put your trust in him. That's what the birth story is all about. And so, y'all, if you are wherever you're at and whatever you're doing this Christmas season, I invite you into thinking and meditating and dwelling on this reality. Is Jesus your new Moses? Is Jesus your king? And if not, the gospel writers of Matthew and Luke want to invite you into a story to discover what that looks like. That's what this Christmas season's about. And on this special edition of Whiskey in the Writings, this Christmas edition that pre-releases, I hope you enjoyed, and I hope you learned something new. Here's the thing. We launch in January 2025. We will have our first video go live. It'll go live every single week, and so you can get constant content from us at Whiskey and the Writings. I want to encourage you to like and subscribe. Please help us by liking and subscribing. It allows our channel to grow. It allows our channel to reach more people. And also share. If this is something that you like, man, let your friends, family know about it. Thank you so much for tuning in with us. And I just want to say Merry Christmas from us to you at Whiskey in the Writings. Have a merry, merry Christmas. God bless. And we'll see you in the new year.